Chapter 12, The Penthouse and Rooftop, Tax Strategies. Poor people work hard for their money. Rich people have their money work hard for them. T. Harvard Ecker, Tax Strategies for the Penthouse. At the penthouse level, making more money does not always make you richer. Paul, the doctor, who made $700,000 a year as a doctor and investor, reached a point where making more money made him poorer. Beyond $350,000 a year in adjusted gross income, the tax rate is 50%, but getting real estate professional status, reps, he was able to drastically lower his taxes. When you reach the penthouse level of the wealth elevator, your tax conversation turns even more defensive. Many of my clients who are first-generation millionaires do reach the penthouse at $10 million in assets and even rooftop level at $50 million and beyond. At this stage, your actions are less about acquiring more cash flow and more about mitigating taxes. Even if you are at floor 1, 2, or 3, it's important to discover what's possible in your lifetime. Start absorbing these concepts now so you get a sense of how to think as you move towards the penthouse and even the rooftop. These strategies in this chapter make it possible for you to pay $0 in taxes for life while leaving a legacy for future generations. When you use these strategies, you protect the wealth you've built and relax into your financial goals. You attain passive cash flow that isn't siphoned off into wasted taxes. You learn to buy dream homes, cars, and other assets in ways that completely eliminate taxes. You learn to defer taxes for decades, ideally until you die. And you have wealth to give to what's important to you in the world. Remember that these strategies you use in the penthouse and on the rooftop will apply only at those stages. Don't jump the gun and hit these strategies early. Wait until you're ready to move to these levels of the wealth elevator. With that in mind, let's dive in. I've seen my clients implement some of the following smart strategies for penthouse and rooftop multimillionaires. Forever homes. If you're ready to settle down into one forever home, you can pull out the depreciation of your home via cost segregation. This requires you to work closely with your tax professional. In order to take the depreciation out, your home has to be considered a commercial asset, i.e., not your primary residence. This is another clever tax hack that has emerged from informal interactions amongst investors at my events. One of my clients has a lake house. He rented it out on Airbnb for a year. The same year, he did a cost segregation on the asset and extracted $2 million of losses, put it on his Form 8582 and suspended passive losses, and then used it in the coming years to defer taxes to his death. Exotic cars. I can picture your face reading this header. What? A financial book telling me to go buy a stupid sports car. There's a reason. This advice doesn't come until you reach the penthouse. You've arrived. You've earned the right to splurge on yourself. Plus, cars have some of the best loan rates out there, and you can often work with the car dealer to get your financing with little to no equity as down payment. Keep that cash and invest in other areas. Feel free to ignore your knee-jerk reaction that a car is a depreciating asset class. Unlike normal sports cars or luxury cars many of us already drive, exotics are made in limited quantities. Therefore, they often appreciate in value. If you're looking for a money-making hobby, you could take up deal hunting in this asset class. Upkeep on exotics is not bad either. In recent decades, many exotic brands have been absorbed by regular car manufacturers, and part availability has improved. It's true that fancy exotic cars provide no utility other than getting from point A to B, but that's not the point. The point is buying something really fun because you're no longer that frugal millionaire next door driving a crappy Toyota turned Lexus in the golden years until the wheels fall off. See, we are breaking the paradigms on the rooftop. Most of the content in this book is based on my personal experiences progressing to the penthouse. I prefer to share my experiences rather than give advice. When it comes to exotic cars, though, I have not purchased one personally. I just don't see it as particularly enjoyable, despite being at a certain stage in my wealth building journey. Instead, I prefer my upgraded Ford F-150 Raptor, which is one of the safest cars and can save my time by not having to slow down going over speed bumps or simply going over curbs in the parking lot. I included the topic of exotic cars in this book to illustrate how the wealthy approach financing debt and purchasing aspirational items differently. However, the decision to purchase an exotic car ultimately depends on personal preferences and circumstances. The one thing I wanted to mention with cars is a highlight, you know, the ability to finance with little to no money down, work with your dealer to, a lot of times they can bump up the price of the car to make it work with a loan. Again, you would rather have the least amount of down payment in a car as you would a house. That said, if you're on the rooftop, you may or may not care. You may not want to sit through the financing paperwork and you might want to just be on your way and pay it cash. But for those of you guys who are on floor 1 and 2, just a way to think about car purchases with the least amount of down payment again. Or you can also use our accredited investor banking or your SBLOC to finance that car instead. Super LPs, side letters, loan guarantors. For most LP passive investors, the average investment in deals tends to be around $50,000 to $200,000. This falls right in line with my guideline to not invest more than 5 to 10% of your net worth into any one single project to maintain diversification. However, high net worth investors have additional opportunities available to them. One option is what can be referred to as super LP, which isn't an official term in the space, but sounds really cool. These investors contribute larger amounts than typical limited partners, ranging from $250,000 to over $1 million. This benefits the GP by enabling faster capital raising, reducing administrative fees with less investors, and minimizing the number of tax returns to be completed. The general partnership is thus incentivized to work with these super LPs, as it's a mutually beneficial arrangement. As a higher net worth investor in the penthouse, if you find a deal you like and are comfortable with the sponsor, consider making a larger investment than usual. Initiate the inquiry with a phone call or email to the GP asking if incentives for larger investments over X amount are available. This may result in better treatment, such as a preferred rate of return or an equity boost. These arrangements are often documented through side letters or email confirmations between the involved parties. Some investors seek out new and less experienced operators and write large checks, aiming to negotiate better splits and arrangements. While this practice occurs, I don't personally recommend it. It involves investing with newer operators who have less experience, and that always brings risks. What we've been doing as an investment group lately is bringing our investors as one investor and write one bigger check on behalf of all our investors, thus getting ourselves a better split scheme in larger deals. And this is where we're pooling together our HUI to get better returns for everybody, but also using this to get into better deals with better operators. Again, the really good deals out there aren't really accepting little small investors at under $50,000, $100,000 a piece. The deals that I'd like to get into are on the family office type of level, where people who are coming into those deals, the individual investors, are writing $1, $2 million checks at least. So if we can collate our investor group together and write a $3 million check to get into that deal, that's a great opportunity to get into higher quality deals. Key principals, KPs, or loan guarantors. Another tactic employed by larger net worth investors in syndications is to become a key principal, KP, or loan guarantor on a project. In real estate ventures involving bank loans, there are qualifications to meet in order to obtain the loan. One of those is that the combined net worth of the individuals must be equal to or greater than the loan amount. Typically, a key principal group within the general partnership signs their names as recourse or non-recourse guarantors. If you trust the individuals involved, it may not be a bad idea to sign your name as a key principal and receive a share of the general partnership in the process. However, it is not recommended to engage in the strategy with newer operators, especially if their combined net worth is below the $30 million threshold. Think about it. If the GP's track record and success is legitimate, why is their personal net worth so low? Earnest money for syndications. High net worth investors have another option to participate in real estate syndications by providing earnest money. Similar to home purchases, earnest money is a deposit made when submitting an offer. This concept applies to commercial real estate as well. However, there can be more risks involved in retrieving the money if certain conditions in the purchase and sale contract are not met. In competitive markets, the GP may need to put in significant amounts, such as $500,000 or a few million dollars, to make their offer stand out and have a higher chance of acceptance. Typically, they need to waive contingencies like financing and inspections. If the project does not proceed and close, the earnest money becomes at risk. For newer GPs who lack substantial net worth and liquidity to provide earnest money, high net worth investors may see an opportunity to offer short-term funding in exchange for a small percentage of the general partnership. The specific percentage can range even higher than for a KP, loan guarantor, because it is widely contingent on the GP's need. Initially, this strategy may seem riskier compared to being a KP or loan guarantor. However, one can mitigate risk by understanding how the general partners plan to close the deal on time and where they would source additional funds to fulfill the earnest money commitment if needed. It's important to note that when putting up earnest money, the risk is limited to the amount deposited and the 1 to 3 month period where things are up in the air, where the deal hasn't closed. In contrast, being a KP or loan guarantor exposes one's entire net worth to potential deficiency judgments in case of project failure for the life of the project, which could be 1 to 10 years. Roths and non-Roths. Qualified retirement plans come in two types, Roth and non-Roths. Most people prefer the Roths. The general consensus is that taxes will go up in the future, so it's better to pay taxes now to avoid that higher tax rate in the future. One strategy called the backdoor Roth IRA is to take non-Roth QRP money and push it into the Roth side in the years your AGI is particularly low. In other words, have your assets in your non-Roth accounts converted to your Roth accounts in those years. Pay the taxes in years where your AGI, where your adjusted gross income is lower. And then, to add an even more advanced tactic, have those assets reevaluated at a lower amount while making the conversion. Say you buy a piece of land for $250,000 in a non-Roth QRP, for example, a slow 401k. You then develop the land. While it's tied up in the development process, it's worthless. In theory, you get an appraisal done in that window by a licensed third party to validate a lower value. Now they value the land and in progress at, say, $100,000. Now you convert the non-Roth QRP that converts that $100,000 asset into a Roth and pay the taxes on $100,000 instead of $250,000. Once the development is done, the land and Roth is worth $1 million. You've just squeezed $100 million in the Roth and only had to pay taxes on $100,000. The question on whether or not to use a QRP is one of the most personal and technical items I have advised individuals on. It is a dynamic situation. It takes many years to fund a respectably large QRP, especially since you can only fund it with less than five figures yearly. Sorry if you were the person duped into funding a QRP, but it's never too late to unravel what you've already put in there and get the tax benefits today. At the same time, if you are a handful of years away from government-mandated so-called retirement age, it might make sense to hold out and avoid the small 10% early withdrawal penalty by staying the course. Your tax strategies. I'm happy to offer a gift conversation about which tax strategies will support your financial goals via the form at thewealthelevator.com/club, and let's book your onboarding call. 50 to 100 million and beyond. We haven't yet talked about one level of the elevator. When you reach a certain level of institutional wealth, you climb to the roof and get into the waiting helicopter. It can take you anywhere. A private island, private planes, a mansion in the sky, a compound in the desert. That's because at this stage, you have a net worth of 50 million to 100 million or more. This might seem enticing, but I'm going to be very honest with you. It comes with different forms of complications that might not be worth that next level or two of opulence. To get from the penthouse to this stage, you need an unfair advantage based on personnel, personal knowledge, or industry contacts. Sure, you could passively invest to get there, but it would take some time, potentially a generation or two, who were aligned with sound investing principles and connections. You have to be comfortable with asymmetric investing. You have to take more risks. Keeping one portion of your portfolio secure while making big bets with a minority portion. Not everyone will choose to aim for the penthouse. If you do, I advise you to make the choice before you leave floor 3 and prep the next generation to carry on the journey. To make it to the penthouse, you may have a huge portfolio, but chances are that most of those businesses and holdings are completely random. Getting to the rooftop, on the other hand, requires you to become less of a passive investor and more of a business operator as you create synergies within your holdings and strategic networks. You might be an intelligent individual and sophisticated investor, but unless you have operated a 7- or 8-figure business, you might not have the business acumen to get to the rooftop in your lifetime. Here are some strategies specifically for ultra high net worth folks. Investments with institutional operators. For full transparency, our firm has done over $2.1 billion in assets, 10,000 plus rental units in over 65 individual projects, and we are still considered a non-institutional firm. That is the way I prefer to keep things. I like to keep a cohesive private investor group, get to know our clients personally, and share in those milestone wins along the way. But as my team grows, so does our overhead. I tell investors at some point, our group will grow large enough that we won't be offering the GP-LP splits they're used to now. Why? All businesses get to a point where the principals or owners capitalize on the reputation they have created and turn into an institution, or on rare occasions, close up shop. When that happens, investors may have to seek out a younger, hungrier, smaller track record operator. My seasoned investors know that every time you have to hunt for a new operator, you risk finding a bad apple and introduce the element of counterparty risk, like some unethical operator running off with your money. If you have relationships with other passive investors, you don't necessarily have to start from scratch to rekindle deal flow. Those on the rooftop don't care about doubling their money in 5 years. They don't need to take risks. That's when larger institutional investments start to make sense. Sure, you lose money on the middleman or paying for expensive overhead that a company might have, but you get better reliability when you are not working with an inexperienced operator. That said, investors who have yet to make the penthouse stage need to find middle market operators like us.
The whole, do I bet on the horse or do I bet on the jockey? With the jockey being the operator or the syndicator and the horse is the deal. Most accredited investors aren't able to underwrite the numbers, right? Can't do that. They're not professional underwriters. They don't even have access to the CoStar Yardi data. So I think that's why a lot of that advice says, don't look at the horse, the deal. Just go look at the people, bet on the jockey. But I would put my spin on this. There's different types of operators. There's a spectrum. There's institutional type of operators where they're very large companies. They run billions and billions of dollars of assets. They're very reputable. They're very secure, but their splits and fees aren't going to be a place where it's very good for passive investors. You're not going to double your money in 5 years. It's going to be like doubling your money in 10 years. Pretty low returns. And a lot of these people, you're not going to be able to get into their deal because they want people to write $1 million, $5 million checks. What we do these days is look for people that are on that level experience-wise and don't even take outside investor capital, but we can come in there and write them a big check and get in on those kind of more private family office, semi-institutional level deals. But I think most people who have access to Google, they get these Facebook ads and such. You're looking at these newbie operators under $1 billion of assets under ownership. And a lot of these guys are just playing the fake it till you make it game. We were there at one time when we first got started with this back in 2016. Back then, we were happy to take people in at $35,000. You know, obviously, there's other things on that that we don't do today because those are some of the weaker investors. But when you look at different sponsors or different deals, I would take a look at it like, all right, when I'm evaluating the operator, where do they fall on the spectrum? To me, if you're under $2, $3 million net worth, you really need to be finding this middle market operator. The institutional guys, you're not going to be writing $500,000, $1 million, $5 million checks to get into those higher quality deals. You're not going to have access to them. At the same time, stay away from the people you find on the podcast land, YouTube world, the people who are just good marketers who have done less than $1 billion of deals. Other government-backed investments. The government will sometimes give tax benefits to encourage investors to put money into a specific area. In the early 2000s, there were all kinds of tax breaks for oil and gas drillings. In recent years, the government is pushing for solar power projects. The IRS website even has opportunity zone maps for real estate deals. Oil and gas deals are typically run by shysters and cowboys who I don't trust. Also, being in an oil or gas deal and getting the tax benefits requires you to be put in as a passive GP, which exposes you legally. Another option is opportunity zone deals, which are good for taxes yet are, unfortunately, in locations that are very rough, making them more risky projects. One of my personal investment philosophies is to invest in good to close to transitioning areas where opportunity zones might be a decade or two away from gentrification. I'm not one to be against investing for the long term, but it does mean holding onto an asset in the meantime and operating. On the one hand, opportunity zone projects normally deal with more intricacies with low tenant base. However, if you're an LP, then that's the GP's problem. Personally, I tend to use caution over these investment options, but it's a very personal decision. Your role is doing due diligence on the investments to determine if the risk-adjusted return and tax benefits make sense to you, based on your ability to source other investments. For all you know, they could yield the intended tax benefits but not make any money as an investment. The rooftop isn't for everyone, but regardless of what floor of the wealth elevator you aim for now, know exactly what it will take to get there. Welcome. Enjoy the ride. I wanted to close out this chapter and just saying that the penthouse and beyond is mainly for folks who are going to be trying to hit that in not your generation, but your kids and your kids' kids' generation. If you can get them aligned in this, that said, to progress through this kind of environment, you're going to have to create your own family office with professional set of advisors around you. And really, it becomes like a mergers and acquisitions type of business, where you're trying to pick up synergistic investments that somewhat help each other. Now, if you're just a passive investor getting up to 5-10 million, you may or may not have the business acumen to get to that level. For business owners who grew to $1 million to $10 million of revenue, I think that you have the acumen and the connections to kind of take it to that next level. But it's going to take some sort of transformation or pivot from your original business. And that brings up the whole question of, do you really want to do that? What's really more important to you? And I think that's what we'll get to in this closing section.